You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares.
Hi, welcome to Nick Luck Daily. It is Tuesday the 26th. Of March. We will find out the draw for the Dubai World Cup and all the Group 1 races tomorrow. We are but 4 days away from the big meeting, and what a meeting it's set to be. That is going to be the main focus of today's podcast. Nick is on his way out there, so this is Tom Stanley standing in for him. And broadcaster journalist Rishi Prasad joins me, who is Dubai side and has been for the last 24 hours or so. Rishi, as we go into this Saturday evening's racing, what's your overriding feeling about 2024's meeting?
Tom, having been lucky enough to be in here for a fair few, there have been obviously some great World Cup night renewals, some great meetings, some great memories. But there have been one or two meetings that haven't quite lived up to the billing. The overriding sentiment, looking at the fields for all nine races and the depth of competition throughout the evening, suggests to me that this could be one of the best that we've seen in recent times. Just so many good horses, but also those good horses are going to have to bring their A games because the opposition looks strong.
What is the secret of this meeting's depth, do you think? Is it the sort of sustained, consistent, almost dominant Japanese presence, which I guess across both surfaces just seems to be growing year on year?
Well, to have the very best competition, you need as many of the big players as possible. And we know that Japan have continued to support the best race meetings, whether it's Dubai, Saudi, the Breeders' Cup. They continue to provide certainly a really interesting angle to all those races with their horses who have excelled in recent times. But there are strong American contenders as well. There are a lot of horses from the Aidan O'Brien team. And traditionally, we know that he's a massive player on the international scene. So put all those together in a number of races certainly adds to what is always a very good night. But it certainly now looks as if those races are going to be fiercely competitive when you think of the horses lining up for the World Cup, for the Shima Classic, you know, and the supporting Group 1 and Group 2 races throughout. There are a number of horses from around the world. You know, there's also the South American element that adds a really interesting dynamic. Plus, there are a few locals who I think are pretty confident of big showings in some of the other races as well. So there are just so many elements that have come together. I mean, to put your finger on why they've come together on World Cup night, I suppose there's always the 30 plus million US dollars that will
help
be attractive.
Helps.
But also, again, there's also tradition. And you know, obviously, World Cup has been going since the mid 90s. And it's where we know that traditionally there have been lots of very good races over the years. So those elements and the timing, I suppose, with the extra week between Super Saturday, World Cup night, and a bit of time between Saudi and World Cup night as well, it lends itself to almost the perfect storm this year. It looks as if we could be in for an absolute cracker.
We have a couple of notable absentees from the Alcoz, which is a shame. Tell us a bit more, Rish.
Yeah, sadly, two horses I think would have had a fair shout at the winning the Alcoz, Anaf and Regional, for Mick Appleby and Ed Bethel, respectively. They both miss out on World Cup night. I still think the Alcoz is a terrific race. I know it's minus two big challenges, but I think it's going to be a really good race. I quite like the two fillies in there. And one interesting angle for the two three-year-old fillies I'm talking about, Frost at Dawn and Star of Mystery. Frankie Dettori is going to take the ride on Star of Mystery. Those two fillies carrying 8.5. And so Frankie Dettori will have to do light, but won't be able to do that weight. So Frankie comes in for the ride in the Godolphin Blue, which I thought was quite an interesting angle. Obviously, he's got a handful of decent rides on World Cup night, but this will be one of the best of them.
Is she going to win this fit? I think she will.
I'm not sure she will definitely win. I genuinely think it's between her and Frost at Dawn. I thought the performance they put up on Super Saturday was outstanding, those two fillies. And they're getting plenty of weight from the others. No three-year-old has ever won the Alcoz, which is a little bit of a concern. But I think these two have shown their suitability for the straight course at Meydan. Frost of Dawn was a revelation, dropped back in trip. I don't think being back at six furlongs will be a detrimental to either of those fillies. I can't be certain which one was advantaged or disadvantaged in how they raced last time. Frost of Dawn beat her two horses convincingly by miles, and they were way behind the peloton in the centre of the course. And then Star of Mystery obviously was down the middle. I'm not sure between the two. What do you think?
I'm pretty clear in my mind that Frost of Dawn was convenienced by racing on the far side of the track, which I think was quicker. But I mean, the I think it was a track record. I mean, the time was electric, and coming from off it is not easy to do. Whereas I think getting rolling is an easier thing to do on the straight course at Meydan. So I think Star of Mystery back over six will, I think, comfortably reverse the form.
Okay. You've got more confidence in that than I do, but I genuinely believe those two are going to be hard to beat. Who comes out on top, I'm still debating.
Well, Rich, you've been talking about Charlie Appley there. He joins me on the line now to talk about his four on World Cup night. And Charlie, you'll be pleased to know that Rishi and I are very positive about Star of Mystery with Frankie up. It's exciting.
Yeah, no, she goes there in good form. Obviously, the back of finishing second on her last start there. I think the step back up to six is not a negative either. And obviously, we're still waiting on the draws, which will be on Wednesday. But she's a filly, like I say, goes there in good order. Frankie up. He's been doing plenty of lightweights. He's been telling me there in America, and he's confident he'll be able to do the weight there. So she's going to be a live player.
Has she surprised you, I guess, particularly when she dropped back to five this year with what she's been able to do, particularly how she's been able to come into a race from off the pace?
Yeah, I think the dropping back to five has helped her mentally how to race the right way round. You know, she was a bit keen there over the six and you know, just not going through the line as strong as you'd like to see her. But when we dropped her back to the five there, you know, obviously that early pace, she naturally was just there behind the bridle a bit more than normal and therefore then came into the race the right way round. So stepping back up to six after those two starts over the five, I would hope that she's matured now and will race the right way round. We'll hit that line strong. Look, it's, you know, we have been competing against one another during the course of the winter. And now stepping into World Cup night, you know, it's a stronger event. So we need to find a bit more improvement. But, you know, we're confident that you know, she goes in great order.
And depending on what happens, you've sort of said from the outset, not necessarily a Commonwealth Cup filly, right, because of the stiff six at Ascot, or has that changed?
Yeah, I still feel that the stiff six at Ascot will probably be a challenge for her. But, you know, she's a group winning filly now. And you know, that was our aim. And so, therefore, you know, anything going into World Cup night, if we happen to, you know, nick a goal there, we'll be delighted. And for her to go on for a three-year-old career, everything from there on will be a bonus.
Yeah, just chuck her in the King's Stand if she wins nicely, Charlie. Simple as that.
It's straightforward stuff, really, Tom.
Siskani, obvious claims, I guess. In the Gold Cup,
he goes there in great order. Off his two starts here, he is what he is. This guy, he does what it says on the tin. We've put the cheap pieces back on again there because William just felt on the last start there. He said I was travelling strong enough. I felt I could have gone through the line stronger. But obviously, he has previously raced in cheap pieces, and we purposely left him off, you know, to hopefully go to the bag with those on World Cup night. He's got a nice draw there in six, so hopefully, you know, he can just drop in right in behind the pace there, and from there onwards, William will hopefully ride his race as he sees fit. It's a good renewal of the Gold Cup, so he's going to have to be on his A game to be a player.
It's looking a very good renewal of the Shima Classic. Rebel's Romance obviously look very, very good in Qatar last time. He's a Breeders' Cup winner. He's double figure odds wise in the international market because it's a deep race.
this is it. I mean, it is always probably one of the strongest races of the night, to be honest. The mile and a half on the turf is what everybody's looking for. And like I say, going into this this year's renewal, it's there's plenty of strength and depth there. And as you quite rightly say, on the figures in the market there, it's Rebel's Romance has got to be well up on his A game to be a player. But I'm confident he goes there in good order, as I had sort of mentioned to you before. You know, we went to Kempton to get his confidence up, and we were you know, what we saw, we were very happy of him coming out of that race and going into Qatar with the confidence behind him again. Will gave him a great ride that day, and I have to say, you know, the horse has come out in great order. So there's no negatives on this horse going into it at all. You know, we know he obviously is one round Maidan, but that was on the dirt a few years ago now in the Derby. But you know, what he's done on the turf since then has obviously stepped him up to a different level. And you know, he's going to be a big player around there, but he's going to have to be on his A game to be a player as well.
He's versatile. Breeders' Cup off the pace last time on it. His two best career runs, it would seem, on the figures. What's he best served by ride wise?
I personally would just say just a nice forward ride. I don't think he needs to lead, especially at the level he's going to be, you know, stepping up to again there this weekend. But I think any of those sort of, you know, when you're dropping in like he has done in the past, it makes it harder work when you've got proper Group One horse up on the front end. They don't tend to come back to you. So I feel the closer he is to the pace, it'll make his assignment slightly easier for him to be best placed to finish strong.
Are you picturing your beer in a Shima Classic, Charlie? That's what you're thinking, isn't it?
It might have been one that just got away, but anyway, we move on.
We do indeed. With Measured Time, who how good is he?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we've always liked the horse. Obviously, a half brother to Rebel's Romance. Rebel's Romance being by Dabawi and this fellow by Frank Russo, two fantastic sires. And we've had, you know, confidence in this horse from the early days with him on the back of Rebel's Romance, really. But himself as a physical, he's done very well. Obviously, he's won his two starts in Dubai there, stepping up from the Grade Two there to the Grade One on the Jebel Hatter on his last start. He couldn't have done it any easier, but this is another step up again in respects to the caliber of horses he's taking on. So I'm far from saying we're sitting on the fence. We're going there confident. The horse is in great order, and we have the confidence. We feel this horse is a proper Group One horse. It's just you've seen us. We have stepped up to the mile and a half. I didn't feel he was anywhere near as effective at that. So we come back in trip. I just hope this nine is not going to be too sharp at this level. Obviously, we know he's won at Grade One level in the Jebel Hatter over the nine, but like I say, this is a different ball game on Saturday night.
And it sounds like you're saying after this European campaign, 10 furlong horse likely.
That's what I do feel. I feel 10 furlongs is going to be his optimum trip.
Charlie, thanks for your time. Good luck.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Now, we don't have a great South African presence in Dubai anymore. That could be changing, Rish. Which your time in Dubai over the years, you'll have been used to seeing plenty of South African winners, plenty of Mike de Kock trained winners. He's been a notable absentee, not just from World Cup night the last few years, but also from the carnival itself. Why might it be changing?
Yeah, it's been a long, drawn out process. I mean, for a start, horses from South Africa always endured an arduous journey to make it over to Dubai to compete at the carnival. They'd have to spend time in Mauritius, where they were relatively inactive by a racehorse's athletic standards. So they spend, I think, a fair amount of time, I can't remember, but months in Mauritius. And then they'd have to go from Mauritius to the UK. They'd quarantine somewhere in Newmarket, and then having quarantined in those two countries, then they fly to Dubai. So it used to be tough anyway. But there was an outbreak of African horse sickness, I think, more than a decade ago. And after that, it meant that all horses in South Africa, all equine disciplines, meant that horses in South Africa couldn't travel, couldn't be exported from South Africa abroad. But the ban on export of horses to the EU was lifted on Monday. And you touched on the fact, Tom, about Mike de Kock and the South African influence at the World Cup. I mean, obviously, at the World Cup meeting, the carnival, not only South Africa in Dubai, but also South Africa in Europe and competing at Royal Ascot, etc. It was always a really good angle or an added interest to have those horses competing. And one of the criticisms of this year's Dubai Racing Carnival has been the fact that it's been dominant, certainly in turf races, from the Charlie Appleby team, the Godolphin team. But Mike de Kock used to be a huge competitor to Saeed Bin Saroor and the Godolphin team back in the day when they dominated, but they didn't dominate to the same influence that they do now. And Mike de Kock, over the years, had tremendous success, and he raced so many top-class horses that he was able to bring from South Africa, go through that process, and turn them into top-class horses, not only in Dubai, but they would then travel beyond that, whether it was a JJ the jet plane going off to Europe, or horses even racing in America. It certainly was one of the best and most exciting elements of Carnival's years gone by, when the South African influence made it tougher for the Godolphin team, made it more interesting from an international point of view. But it seems as if those days might be coming back again, with the news that ban has been lifted. It's great news for South Africa. It's great news for the international competition. And very, very glad to see it as a racing fan.
Well, to give us a bit more on this from a South African perspective is senior manager at broadcast and commentator at Cape Racing, Alistair Cohen. Alistair, welcome along. All in all, this is nothing but very good news for the industry, surely.
Yeah, it's huge. Hey, Tom, and to all the viewers, it's fantastic news to come out of South Africa. It's been a long time coming. You know, the audit's been held up for various reasons. South African horses have not been able to be exported directly into the EU since 2011. Here we are 13 years later with some great news. I mean, the holdup had a lot to do with COVID and various hurdles that needed to be cleared that took a long time, or a longer time than anticipated. But we finally got to the finish line, and hopefully we'll get some South African quality on the world stage, which, as we know, looking back in the history books, there is quite a presence.
Do you think the last just over a decade or so has had an impact within South Africa on the quality of horses coming through, or has it just been more globally the fact that they haven't been able to travel and win races abroad so easily?
I think first thing is to spare a thought for the connections of top horses here in South Africa that haven't been able to get out. Horses like Comet de Ding, Charles Dickens, Jet Dog, Captain's Ransom, Do It Again, and various others who have shone on the South African stage and never knowing whether they were good enough to compete on the international stage. And judging by history, they probably would have had a good chance of going to places like Dubai, potentially Hong Kong, and lifting a little bit of silverware. I think overall the biggest concern, the biggest negative impact, is that a lot of the breeders were chopping down their stock in terms of mares, and I think this will alleviate the pressure on a lot of buyers and a lot of breeders to be able to expand the mare population. So I think overall on the South African tracks we've been quite lucky in that we've not lost all of the talents and all of the class over the last 10 years, but you know, financially and also in terms of expanding horizons and living for what you want to achieve on the world stage, obviously it's been a missed opportunity over the last 13 years.
Are we going to see some immediate changes, do you think, or is this going to be more of a slow burner?
I think it's going to be pretty immediate. There was a batch of about 10 horses that recently went over to the United States, horses like Issy Vungu Vungu, who will be aiming for some races in America, Bless My Stars, Feather Boa, Beach Bomb, all very good horses here in South Africa, but they've taken the early route, which includes, I think, a 60-day quarantine in the USA. But now that it's open season and the gates are pretty much open, I think that by the time we get to the end of the Durban season, which will be at the end of July, horses that have competed during that feature race season, that carnival, so to speak, I think there'll be quite a few that'll be heading over as soon as possible.
And what about those international buyers that are heading to South Africa to try and pick up some horses to perhaps bring back and race in their different jurisdictions? Again, is there anything immediate that's likely to change there?
Well, in the past, we've had quite a lot of Hong Kong participation at the National Yearling Sales. Guys like Tony Millard and David Ferraris, who are obviously South African, who have made their presence felt at our National Yearling Sale, which is held in April, and being able to either test the waters in South Africa, see if they're of a sufficient quality, and take them over to Hong Kong or wherever they need to go, or take them directly into Hong Kong. So I think the new move will hopefully bring a lot more international buyers into the picture, whether they go straight on to the international stage or whether they stay in South Africa, test the waters, see if they are of a graded quality. That all remains to be seen. But there are a lot of options coming out of that, and all of a sudden, breeders and buyers and trainers are a lot more excited for the marquee sale next month.
Thanks, Alistair.
Cheers, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Well, as we build up to Saturday night in Dubai, we continue our series looking at those who have shaped racing in Dubai over the last three decades. Here's Laura King.
Mohammed Al-Shahi is one of the driving forces of racing in the Emirates. A Group 1 winning owner in his own right, he's the general manager of the Emirates Racing Authority, which governs the sport across the UAE. He's also the chairman of ARM Holdings and somehow finds the time to oversee the running of Jebel Ali Racecourse. With the help of general manager Mohammed Ahmed, Al-Shahi has transformed Jebel Ali from quaint but a little tired to one of the most Instagrammable places in Dubai.
To start with, I'm a small member of a big team that runs Jebel Ali, and I think Mohammed Lahmad and Ahmed Shahi, they have great ideas, and my role is only to give them the vision and support them to achieve their ideas and their initiatives. I think Jebel Ali came a long way in the last 3 years. You have told me this the last time you were here, but I'm happy to report that most of the race courses and the clubs in UAE are coming along. I saw this year Abu Dhabi has transformed completely. Sharjah has few initiatives as well. They have the sprint series, which was again supported by Sheikh Ahmed Al Maktoum. We had some of the top sprinters competing in Sharjah. Al Ain as well, it's the home of Arabian races and some thoroughbred racing, is trying to run some initiatives there. And Maidan is Maidan. Dubai Racing Club has done an extremely well job in the past few years, and they continue to do so. So I'm happy to say that all the race courses are developing and are trying new initiatives to give race goers a new experience while they watch the races here.
In his Emirates Racing Authority role, Al-Shahi has endeavoured to unite all five tracks in the UAE, working closely with Abu Dhabi, Sharjah and Al Ain, as well as Maidan and Jebel Ali.
Once there is the vision from our leadership, it's a matter of aligning everyone, and I think getting everyone on the same table helps. And I have to say I'm grateful for the support of my colleagues at the clubs, who are always there to support each other and help each other. And the success today of Dubai Racing Club is the success of Jebel Ali, is the success of Abu Dhabi, and vice versa.
Another part of Al-Shahi's role is managing Jebel Ali Stables, which has been home to Australian trainer Michael Costa for the past two seasons. Costa is likely to be crowned UAE champion trainer for the first time, while Sheikh Ahmed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, think Yellow Silks and you'll know who we mean, will be champion owner.
I think when Sheikh Ahmed asked me to look after the job for him, I think that was the aim. And achieving this really gives me a great sense of pride, you know. And I managed to bring the colors of Sheikh Ahmed, you know, along with his direction and his vision, back to the top where it belongs. Michael Costa is running for the Trainers Championship as well, but again, it's a huge effort by Michael and his team. They have a small string of horses compared to the other trainers, but they're competing hard. No Arabians. And they're competing with bigger stables, with bigger number of horses, and they're doing it well. And I think Michael is still learning, and next year he'll be better.
Mohammed Al-Shahi, a man with many missions.
Rishi, domestically, some really grim news coming out of Ireland about an assault on a couple of jockeys that rode at the Cheltenham Festival. Tell us more.
Yeah, this is very distressing to see, disgraceful. disgusting behavior, really. It involves two jockeys who rode at the Cheltenham Festival, and both of them won Grade One races, Sam Ewing and Jack Kennedy. Both of them had, I think, pretty good meeting, but they were out on an evening out in Nace, and they were confronted by a group of men. This is all alleged, of course, and seemingly those men became somewhat intrusive on the evening that Sam Ewing and Jack Kennedy were having, and it became physical, became violent, and they, as a consequence, there is now a police investigation to what happened on that night. Now, I know we've spoken a lot over the years about the influence of social media. For example, people feel they have a right to criticize, discuss, on occasions go beyond discussing and be very, very aggressive towards people who compete in racing, jockeys, trainers, etc. And that's bad enough as it is. But for it to become a reality in person and for it to become aggressive and violent is a very worrying sign, just beyond what's happened to Sam and Jack. And obviously what's happened to Sam and Jack, assuming that this is all as reported, that sounds awful, absolutely awful. But beyond it, looking at what's happened and this case, you can't worry, where will it end? And if this is what people are prepared to do, if they're happy to just confront people that they see in the public eye and criticize them and take it to violent steps, to aggressive steps, to physical steps, then hopefully if this is the case, the law will come down hard on them as some sort of preventative measure, as some sort of way of stopping people feeling that they have the right to assault and verbally, physically assault people who are in the public eye and who are competing and trying to do. In the case of Sam and Jack, I thought they had really good festivals. Thought they did as well as could possibly be. But I'm assuming that there might have been alcohol or whatever else involved in it. But it's just unacceptable behaviour, and hopefully behaviour that we won't see again.
Well, this weekend, trainer Martin Brazel plans to run Desert Moor House in the Boyle Sports Irish Grand National at Fairy House. That's on Easter Monday. He won it with number 6 Valverde back in 2005, and he told Dennis Kerwin there are lots of similarities between both horses.
He didn't run over fences till he was 8. This fella the same. They're well mature and not over raced, really, over hurdles as well, because Desert Moor House was almost at the end of his 6-year-old career when he won his first pint-to-pint, first time out.
3.5 miles. It takes a fair bit of getting, so it's interesting to see how novices have such a good record in the race.
It is, really, yeah, but like, stamina isn't a problem with Desert Moor House. Like, he was placed over 3 miles, won over 3 miles. I think the further he goes, the better he'll be.
All right, let's get all time form on this Tuesday with Time Form's Dan Barber. We had a little look at the Brocklesby last week. Dave Ord was on talking about projected ratings for the two-year-olds. What's the look back, tell us, Dan?
Yeah, well, this is a miniature who won the Brocklesby this time around. Sort of a statement with South African trainer Dylan Cunha. It wasn't a vintage Brocklesby winner by any means. Rated in the low 80s. Persian Force sets a recent standard in that race when he absolutely hacked up a couple of years ago. But I just wanted to touch on the wider point of the trainer. Such a fascinating story. A successful operator in South Africa, Grade 1 winner. Had a spell as an airline pilot, which I found remarkable too. And then quite quickly, he's established himself as an extremely good trainer, Dylan Cunha, and mentioned the statement winning in the Brocklesby. Just some underlying numbers that we've dug up at Time Form, just to chart his progress. Now, his run-to-form ratio is about 52 and 53% over the course of his career, which is good in itself, but it's the rise in the other numbers that you might be interested in. The win percentage compared to this has gone from 14% to 18%. And most tellingly of all, perhaps, just about a trainer who's getting his horses right and targeting them in the right races where they can show the form. His place percentage has gone from 21% in his first season, 35% last, and he's operating around 48% at present. So really impressive numbers from a trainer who continues to make waves and seems likely to carry on doing so.
Is he underestimated then, do you think, and may be so for the sort of early part of this season?
Well, I saw somebody on Twitter likening it to the impact that George Bowie and trainers like that have tried to make down the years. Be ready to go early to make a statement. Just get yourself in that short window, and he's getting a lot of support. He's probably been able to spend a few more quid than he was able to, so the quality should improve as well. And you don't need much better examples than you and I spent a bit of time on Sunday Series race courses last season, didn't we, Tom? And Silver Sword, a horse who started his career, I think with back-to-back refusals, went on to be in a winner, and I think finishing placed in a Sunday Series race too. So, yeah, a guy who maybe not everyone's familiar with yet, but I'm sure they will be so in the not-too-distant future.
What did you want to tell us about going descriptions? Again, something we touched on the pod last week, and disparity in said descriptions. How can Timeform help us?
Yeah, well, I think fundamentally, Timeform can be sort of dispassionate and objective on the matter. We've got a wealth of data and times dating back to God knows when, so many thousands of examples of races and race cards in which the times suggest the going should be one thing or the other. We'll move on to turf in a week or so when we've got more detailed numbers on those, but I thought it was quite striking even looking at all-weather racing. So obviously this kicked off in light of Cheltenham. Timeform certainly thought the ground for the Supreme was heavy. It was 5 seconds slower than any other Supreme this century. And retrospectively, I think those connected with the track have agreed that it probably should have been heavy for the opening race. But just compare it to the all-weather, where you'd think everything was much of a muchness, the going standard, and you just accept it standard. But in only 29% of cases when the official going since 2020 on all-weather was standard, have Timeform agreed with that. In actual fact, in 56% of the races, when it's been called standard, Timeform have called it slow. And then official going, when that's standard to slow, only 12% agreement between Timeform and the official. And often when it's standard to slow, even more so, we think it's a bit slower than that. And we'd say in 68% of cases, there's a difference there. And you've got a very recent example going back to this weekend across Friday, Saturday and Sunday. Basically, every going description differed from what Timeform viewed it to be. They're all called standard at Newcastle, Linkfield and Wolves. And Timeform believed they were all standard to slow or slow. So even on all weather racing, there can be disagreement. It's not to say Timeform are always right by any means, Tom, but we do have such a wealth of data to try and compare previous going assessments. And I did hear Lydia last week saying that she would prefer to refer to ours when it comes to having a sort of dispassionate and hopefully accurate assessment of what the going was on the day. And I think going back to the Cheltenham point, what is to stop people nowadays to say, oh, well, we're going to change it after race one because of what happened in race one? Why can't we just say, well, retrospectively, it was heavy in race one too, and we're going to call it that in the form book?
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Thomas.
All right, it's Tuesday. We go around the bloodstock world with our friends at Weatherby's. Today, Nick is off to the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, where he's caught up with Arthur Mitchell from Yarraman Stud. That's a breeding enterprise whose stock rose so steeply with the arrival of the world-class stallion I Am Invincible. Nick begins by asking Arthur about the history of this thriving family business.
Yarraman began, my father used to travel a bit with a famous bloodstock agent called George Blackwell, and they came to Australia. They happened to do a trip to the Hunter to stay with George Moore, the jockey, obviously well known to older English racing fans. And Dad loved the place and said to George, if you ever want to sell it, give me first refusal. This is in 1966, I think, 67. And we were on, then George wrote to him and we were on our way out here at the end of 68.
So you went out as a young boy. How much do you remember of your life in England before?
Enough. I mean, I still had a lot of English. Enough. We were sort of brought up in Norfolk, farming sort of family. So I remember a bit, and I went to school at a place where the Weatherbys went to school, in England, at prep school, and then came out here when I was 13. Brothers were sort of 12 and, 8.
And the establishing of the stud, tell me about the early days and how your father managed to get it going.
Well, it was quite a George having travelled overseas, so he sort of had a sort of rather lots of white white fences and all that sort of thing. But Dad was, he wasn't really a commercial breeder. We stood stallions and we had a few mares and a few clients. But Dad, you know, he wasn't really a commercial breeder. We sold a few yearlings and raced a few. But really when my brother Harry and I took it over, we sort of started to become a lot more commercial and upgraded the farm as we could.
And did you think when you were growing up, yeah, this is what I'm going to do? Did you immediately have an affinity with that side of life, or were there other plans?
I think because we came to a horse stud and we started to get involved in all that, I mean, it sort of suddenly became what we were going to do. I presume if we'd stayed in England, that we're farmers, we would have been soldiers of some sort probably, or some of us would have been. That's what the family seemed to do. So it sort of morphed into that. We all worked overseas, either on studs or with trainers, and it just sort of became what we were going to do.
And so you say that you and your brother were set out to make the stud more commercial. How did you go about doing that?
But well, basically, the stud was probably quite run down when we started to take over. So, I mean, we just traded our way. We, you know, bought and sold mares, and we, you know, did our best at yearling sales. We stood a few mediocre stallions, and we basically just battled along trying to get better. And, you know, as you do, I suppose.
And then came a real turning point, and a turning point that everybody in the bloodstock world will know about. Tell me a little bit about I Am Invincible and how that all came together.
I suppose the funny thing is we always knew about the horse. We'd watched him race a bit. I followed overseas racing, so I knew Invincible Spirit was on the way up. He, you know, he wasn't a Group 1 winner. He'd run second to Take Over Target. We'd always known he was good-looking. He wasn't even an expensive yearling. So we did talk to the owners. We agreed on a deal. We flew down and we said, when this horse comes out of the box, we've got to absolutely love him. And the horse, just the three of the... both my brothers and I were there. We flew to Melbourne. The horse came out of the box and we didn't honestly have to think twice. He was such a lovely horse. We said, we've got to give this horse a chance.
And the obvious question is, why wasn't everybody else wanting to give him a chance?
Well, I don't know. And I think he was offered to quite a few other farms before us. So I'm not sure. I mean, maybe they didn't think he was good enough. And I suppose on his record, on his race record, he probably wasn't really. So, I mean, that's why he started at a pretty, pretty low fee.
And immediately did you get the sort of interest you wanted when you set the fee and started to advertise him? What was the initial reaction?
The main thing was getting people on farm to look at him. So we never got any of the big commercial breeders. We were dealing with smaller breeders, sometimes with better mares than having the C graders from the big farms. So we sort of worked hard, got people on farm. They loved the horse. You know, his foals came out fabulous. We sort of just started to grow the momentum from there. And then they started running at two and got better and better and better.
And was there a moment when one of his progeny did something where you thought, we've cracked it, we've got one here, and this is going to be a really important time for this place?
I think it was when a horse called Brazen Bow, who probably should have won at Ascot, I think it was when he won the Coolmore, you know, sort of 10-1 shot, I think, you know, and then suddenly he bolted up in that. We went, wow, this is getting serious. And that was probably probably a game changer for us, his first Group 1 winner.
And then in terms of having a stallion of that caliber and curating his career, that I guess in itself posed you not a challenge, it's a lovely challenge to have, but took you into a different realm, if you like. How did you enjoy that adjustment and how did you manage that?
We weren't exactly small breeders before that, because we did send mares out to Proven Stallions. So we had actually, enjoyed one huge sale at Easter where we had the two record-priced Australian yearlings. And, so we have had some success in what we were doing. We weren't as such sort of battling breeders, but, we'd never really stood a hot stallion, semi-commercial one. So it didn't change us much. All it really did was, gave us an opportunity to buy better mares and do a bit more to the farm, that sort of thing.
Tell me a little bit about the successors to I Am Invincible. Who is going to keep flying the flag for Yarraman in the decades to come?
Yeah, well, that's a bit interesting. We've got a son of his here called Hellbent, who's doing very well, actually. You know, he's had a Group One winner. He's doing really well. He's a sort of smaller version of his dad. And then we took on a Japanese horse called Brave Smash, who won two Group Ones at Wake for Age here, who has a sort of a real shad-eye sort of pedigree double cross of Northern Taste, you know, than the Sunday Silent Sireline. So, you know, he's got three-year-olds now. He's got a couple of good group winners. So we're hopeful. But, you know, having said that, we're on the lookout. We're always on the lookout for another horse. Always. Absolutely. Well, not easy to find down here.
Rishi, back with you. Just a tip, please, sir.
I'm going to have a tickle, Tom, in the 6:45 at Southall on Dawn of Liberation, a horse who was once rated in the hundreds, low hundreds, when with Richard Hannon, now with Ruth Carr. Didn't run too badly earlier this month, down to a mark in the mid-80s. I know he's got top weight. I think he's got a good chance of winning.
Mr. Tickle with his long, tickly arms. Good luck.
Tickle Tuesday.
Yep. Tickle Tuesday, the 26th of March. Nick will be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.